Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you live and in person on this Tuesday, August the 3rd, 2021. And away we go here on this beautiful Tuesday. Could not get any better weather-wise here in Marion, Ohio than on this Tuesday. Hope you enjoyed the show yesterday. The author of Three Pies Hot, Bob Welsh, was in here yesterday. And we do have some copies of that book available. They are available at the Marion County Historical Society as well, which is great because it's a tremendous story. And I did not even know that this pizza shop existed, started in Marion, which could have progressed to a national chain. But because of bad management and some unforeseen circumstances, such as the passing of the brother of Mr. Welsh, Mike Welsh, it didn't seem to go that way. So it's a very interesting story, all chronicled in Three Pies Hot. And of course, the book goes a lot more in-depth than what we were able to do here on the radio yesterday, as the book has memos in it that were sent from the owner of the business to the employees, and it really chronicles in-depth what happened. It really is a fascinating, fascinating story. We're going to be joined by a guest here momentarily, and it's going to be another fascinating story here this morning. And if we have time at the end of the program, we might do some giveaways. We'd like to get back to that. That is always a lot of fun to do the giveaways here on WWGH Radio. So we will see how that all ticks out here this morning as the morning progresses. Our guest should be with us any time now. And the guest today goes to the old adage of things that can happen in life, and we will hear his story of everything that seemingly went on with his particular story. So hopefully we will have that connection here momentarily on WWGH Radio. Had some weird phone problems yesterday. We did get to take one call yesterday morning for the Three Pies Hot author, but I have something to bring up, by the way, and we're going to get into this more next hour. But I was pulling, well, let's go to our guest here and just remind me to come back to this next hour, because I think this is very, very important. But our guest this hour is a minister. He is an ambassador to the United Nations, but he has a very interesting story to tell. He was falsely, well, in his own words, and we'll get to this in a second, falsely accused and wrongly convicted of rape in the 1990s. He served a statutory life sentence in the state of Michigan, 1992 through 2008, for this crime, and is still a registered sex offender in the state of Ohio. Now, we're going to hear this whole story and what happened and how it relates to things that went on as of late with the legendary comedian Bill Cosby. But we're proud to welcome to this program Ambassador to the United Nations and Minister Kujinga Ashe. Minister Ashe, how are you?
I'm fine, Scott.
Good to speak with you. I want to get right into this. Take me back to 1992, or prior to that. When did this all start? Where were you? What happened?
First of all, let me thank you for this interview. I did not know. I asked my famous brother to get you some information to Mr. William Cosby, because I tried to get in touch with him a number of times. I didn't know I'd be blessed with an interview, but since you've asked, In 1991, my would-be wife, a fiance that I broke off an engagement with, that I had a young child by, decided that she wanted to get rid of me because I was in love with another woman, the current woman that I'm married to now. She's a great artist, Lene Ashe. And this woman, Carla Ann White, I'm not afraid to say her name, well, she's dead now. She died in a horrible, tragic accident in Cleveland, Ohio in 2001 while I was in prison. I guess what goes around does really come around. Anyway, she convinced my eldest daughter, Sana Bray Ashe, who was mentally unbalanced, to say that I had raped her when she was 16 years old, which was from 1992, would have been several years prior. I lived in Ohio. My daughter, Sana, lived in Ohio. Everybody lived in Ohio, in Columbus, Ohio, where I was born and raised. I went to the Ohio State University. I have a bachelor's and a master's degree from there in 1976, 1980, respectively. They came with a warrant from Michigan, and they arrested me here in Columbus. I didn't fight any extradition. I went to Michigan on my own free will, and I sat there in front of a jury in 1992, a year later, and after I had the preliminary exam, the judge went to sleep during the preliminary exam, and then during the trial in 1992, the age changed from 16 to 15 so I could get more time. My Sana's mother, my ex-wife, decided she'd join into the party. We had a very bad divorce back in the 80s. And basically, I had three women who made up a false accusation against me that I had raped my daughter when she was 16. Of course, when I got to trial, I was 15, so I would get more time. They took the only man of color, Ken Harrison, off of my jury purposely at the end, so that I would be convicted. He was, of course, an all-white jury. I think there was one woman of color from India or somewhere on there. But they made sure that Ken was off of there, and he met me in the hallway in 1992 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the Washtenaw County Courthouse, and said, I would have fought for you because I knew you were innocent. I said, yes, I am innocent. He said, but they purposely took me off the jury. I watched the court secretary picked through all the towels until she came to my number and then hand that to the judge. Well, 16 years later, I met Ken Harrison again by the providence of God Almighty. I met him in a church, Metropolitan Baptist Church, and he wrote a letter for me about how he knew that I was innocent and how he tried to convince the other people during the jury breaks. But basically, after they took him off the jury, there was nobody to fight for me. All it took was one point of the finger from my 18-year-old daughter at trial to say that I had raped her. They convicted me of first-degree criminal sexual conduct, which is rape, and then they sent me directly to jail in Washtenaw County and then to Jackson State Penitentiary, and from there to several other Michigan prisons where I served a statutory life sentence for a crime that never even occurred. And this happens to a lot of black, brown, and red men, and even poor white men that can't afford good lawyers. I had a public a public defender, and I did not have proper representation. I did not testify at my trial, and they ended up putting me in jail in Michigan for 16 long years, where I served in several different penitentiaries, mostly Hiawatha, which is the upper peninsula of Michigan. And that's basically what happened to me. And I was trying to contact Mr. William Cosby because I felt that he had been done an injustice, and he was a great entertainer. I would put him up there with Charlie Chaplin. And I could not get in touch with him, so I asked that you forward my information to him since I heard that you were going to interview him. Basically, that's my story, Scott. I can go into a lot of details, tell you a lot of things that I do at the United Nations. I'm a licensed ordained Baptist minister, have been since 1982. I do a lot of things in the community in Linden. I go to the United Nations to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Peoples Issues once a year. Basically, God has restored me to even a greater height than I was before I went to the prison. Most of the ministers in town believe in my innocence. They put me back into all of the organizations. I am the benevolent secretary for the Baptist Ministerial Alliance of Columbus and Vicinity, my hometown here, like I said, where I was born and raised at the Ohio State University, where I was born, back here in Columbus. I'm a number of different things for the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance. So basically, that's my story, Scott, and you might have some questions, but that's basically it, and that was what I wanted to get across to Mr. William Cosby, because I've written three books while I was in the prison, Eden's History 2000 and Beyond, which was on Amazon Kindle. I pulled it off to edit it. I still have two books on Amazon Kindle, one entitled Salvation Theology, which is a 2,500-page treatise dealing with religion and my entire story, and also with some of the social problems we have here in America. And my third book is entitled Third Millennium Prophets, which is only a 100-page handbook. Both of those are still on Amazon Kindle. So that's basically what I've been doing with my life. I'm married to the love of my life, my wife, and I'm here in Columbus, Ohio, in South Linden, kind of serving as the provisional mayor of South Linden. My wife is on a commission, the South Linden Area Commission, and we're just here doing all the best we can for the people here in Columbus that we love and that we cherish so much. That's my story, Scott.
Minister O'Shea, we want to go back and just clear, because when people hear, and I'm sure you understand the cynicism, when somebody hears that somebody served a statutory life sentence for rape, and then somebody comes on and says, well, I did not rape the person, there is some skepticism. So let's do a little bit of a dive on this for people who haven't heard of this case. Now, at the trial, was there any DNA, was there any police officers testifying, was there anything that would have indicated that you did rape the girl?
Absolutely not. There was no DNA, there was no medical test done, there was no psychological test done. All it took was for my 18-year-old daughter to point her finger at me and say that he raped me. And she said that she had on... She told the officer, Officer Paul Vaughn, who is also dead now, Sergeant Paul Vaughn, he got promoted to lieutenant because he got me convicted in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This is where I took my daughter for a trip once, and that's why we were in Michigan. We went on a trip. But basically, there is no DNA, no evidence, no police report. She told the officer, Paul Vaughn, who came to my house in Columbus, Ohio, and knocked on my door with a Ohio State University police officer because he had no jurisdiction in Ohio. And they knocked on my door, and they told me about the accusation. I went to Michigan after they sent down a warrant without any extradition, fighting any extradition. I went there to answer the false charge, and they kept me for 16 long years without any evidence. And that happens to a lot. You have a huge prison there in Marion. I visited people there before I went to the prison years ago, and a lot of men there, black, brown, red, and white men, are wrongly convicted and falsely accused because all it takes is a jury to believe the woman's story. And if they believe her story, regardless of what the man says, especially if it's a man of color, he's up a creek. And if he doesn't have a lot of money to pay a good lawyer, he's going to the penitentiary. And that's what they did. There is absolutely no evidence. All the evidence is in my favor. She told the police officer she had on panties and that I took them off and I raped her. And then he got on stage on the stand and said that. When she got on stand, she said that she didn't have on any panties and that the police officer was lying. And then they put the police officer back on stage. He said she was lying. But even with that, my attorney, Lauren Brown, it was his first capital case, his first case, a major case, his first capital case. He asked the judge for a directed verdict. He said, apparently, the woman is lying because she said she had on a certain article of clothing and this happened. And then she told the, after she told the police, and then she, on trial, she said it didn't happen that way. She's changed her story, and the officer says she's lying, and she says he's lying. So let's throw out the verdict. Well, the judge, Melinda Morris, was a woman, a white woman. She said, well, since we have a jury, we'll let them decide. And, of course, they decided in her favor, even though the lie was so obvious. And that was just one of the lies. There were many more. So that happens to a lot of poor men, black, brown, red, and white men. All it takes is the pointing of the finger so that he did it. And that's what happened to me. I've got the court transcripts. Anybody can read them at will. I wanted to send those to Mr. William Cosby because I thought he might be able to publicize not only my case, but a number of other cases where you hear a lot of times people have served, especially black, brown, and red, and white men, poor men, have served a lot of time, and then they find out, well, they were innocent, usually through a DNA test. But in my case, there's no DNA. And in a lot of cases, there's no DNA. So basically, Scott, that's kind of an answer to your question.
Minister, you lived with this 18-year-old girl when she was younger who accused you of rape. Why? It's one thing for the mother not to like you. It's one thing for somebody to accuse you, but to get up under oath and continue to say this, why would she do that?
There was a very bad divorce that we had with her mother. This is my oldest daughter, Sana, my oldest child. I raised her up from the time she was born until I divorced her mother in 1981. And her mother put a hatred into the girl for me. And then her would-be stepmother, Carla, even enhanced that hatred. I can't say exactly how they did that. I don't know exactly what psychological procedures they used, but they put that into my child. And at age 18, she decided that she would roll with her mother and her would-be stepmother to do that. And they proceeded to do that, and that's what they did. I do not know what process they used to subvert the child's mind. Well, she was a grown woman at trial. She was 18 years old. And I don't know what they did, but basically that happens a lot when families have bad divorces. They go through a lot of different changes, and the children usually take the position of the mother. And the mother hates the man. And in this case, the mother and the would-be stepmother, who were both friends of my daughter, hated me, and they basically hated my wife that I have now, the woman that I'm married to now. They basically said if they couldn't have me, then nobody could have me. And they convinced my daughter to tell that lie. They supported her in the lie by saying that they believed her story. Of course, there's no witnesses. There's no nothing. And the jury sent me to the penitentiary in Michigan.
Now, your daughter today who made this claim, have you spoken to her in the last, I guess it's been close to 30 years now?
Yes, I saw her several times. I saw her and I talked to her just very briefly. And I said to her, you know, I still love you, even though you did what you did to me. And, you know, I don't know any of, I know one of the grandchildren, my grandchildren by her. He's like 20-some years old now. I talked to her. I told her that I forgave her. I even went to a wedding. One of my youngest sons, Jamal, who was a Navy SEAL, he's just out of the Navy a few years back. My wife and I, my current wife and I, we went to a wedding about 3 years after I got out of the prison. And I talked to my daughter, and I told her, I said, I would like for you to recant your statement. And I told my ex-wife, her mother, Carlita, I call her Kuleta Ashe, I asked her to recant her statement. I said, it would be good if you told the truth so that the Lord would, I've forgiven you, so that the Lord would forgive you, and we could get this thing all straightened out, and I could get off the sex registration list that I have to go to every 3 months. When I was in Michigan and when I came to Ohio, I had to transfer that registration. Every 3 months, I go for a lifetime to the registration here in Franklin County. I did talk to both of them. They didn't do it. I had a innocence clinic from Michigan. The innocence clinic from Michigan sent letters to their house. I don't know the address. I never knew the address, but he knew it. And the innocence clinic sent letters to their house asking them to sign the statement, to recant their statements, so that the case could be overturned or revisited, and they refused to do it. In fact, they told my natural father, Eason Thomas Chubb, who is still alive, he's 88 years old, we usually go bowling every Friday, they told him that if I didn't have my lawyers stop sending statements to their house, they would file some more false charges on me. That's what they told my father. My father, of course, instantly called me. This has been in 2013, so it's been 7-8 years ago. My father calls me and says, look, they want you to have your lawyer to stop sending from the Innocence Clinic these statements to have them sign and recant their statement, or else they're going to tell some more lies on you. So what I did, I took them to court here in Columbus, Ohio, in front of Judge Priest. Now, Judge Priest's brother was the head of the Republican Party here in Franklin County at one time. So I went before Judge Priest with a statement. I didn't have an attorney. I took my wife, my eldest cousin Sheila, and my sister Gloria went with me. And we went to trial, and I was trying to get a stay-away order so that they would stay away from me and leave me alone. And so I took them to court in 2013. The judge, they had a paid lawyer, and the judge asked their lawyer if he knew anything about the trial, what had happened, because I gave them a statement, which I sent you in a package of information. And the lawyer said, no, he said, I didn't know that they had done this to this man. And then he asked my ex-wife, my first wife, Kulita Ashe, they asked that, do you have anything to say to this man about what he said? He's the thin-skinned plaintiff. He was falsely accused. Y'all falsely accused him and sent him to the prison. What did you have to say to that? She just shook her head. She didn't say a word. And then she asked my daughter, Sana, do you have anything to say about what this man has just said in open court? And my daughter shook her head, did not say a word. And then she said to me, Minister Ashe, if these people agree to leave you alone, would you sign off on this complaint? And I said, Your Honor, she said, there is no such thing as a stay-away order, the protection order, but I can't give you that because they're not threatening you with a gun or a knife. But if you sign off on this, if they will agree to leave you and your family alone. So I said, sure, Your Honor. So she said, will you leave this man and his family alone? Asked my ex-wife. She shook her head, yes, never said a word. She asked my daughter, will you leave this man alone? And she shook her head, yes. And then the judge, Judge Priest, looked back at me, and she said, Mr. Ashe, they say that they're acknowledging that they will leave you alone and your family if you sign off on the order, because I do not have a such thing as a stay-away order, and I can't give you a protection order because they are threatening you with physical violence. I said, okay, Your Honor. So I signed off, and they went out of the courtroom. And then their lawyer came over to me and said, Mr. Ashe, I'm sorry. I did not know that these women had done that to you. And if I did, I would not have represented them in this case. He gave me his card. I still have his card. He said, if they give you any more problems, give me a call. And he gave me his card and then left out of the courtroom. That was in 2013 that I took them to court. And since that time, I spoke to my daughter several times, and I saw her just in passing at different venues, at the mall, different things like that. But I still forgive you. I still love you. Still my daughter, even though you've done this, because God says I'm supposed to love. I'm supposed to forgive. And, you know, she just smiled and said, you know, walked on, that kind of thing. But basically, that's the answer to that question you just asked.
Had she ever, in private or in public, obviously not in front of anybody in law enforcement or any jury, but had she ever told you or recanted why she did this in private?
She told my aunt Bertha Hinkle, who's passed away later on in 2013 after that court hearing. She was telling my aunt Bertha that she was sorry that she had done that and that she was doing some, I was doing some soul searching, but she never put anything in writing. While I was in the prison, she did write me one letter while I was in the prison before Carla, her would-be stepmother, died sometime in 1999 or 2000. She did write me a letter while I was in the prison, about in the middle of the sentence. But she's never said anything, of course, to officials. I am assuming that she's afraid of a charge against her for lying to police officers or issuing a false statement. or some type of perjury charge. So neither her nor her mother would sign the statements from the Innocence Clinic in Michigan because I'm afraid they're afraid of going to jail. That's why they got the lawyer in 2013 to come to the hearing in front of Judge Priest. So basically, she did say something to my aunt, and she did write me a letter in the prison, but nothing that I could use in court.
Minister O'Shea, when you went to prison, you were there for quite a while, 15 years.
16 years.
A lot of people have this question. What is prison like for a normal man who goes in there who's never had a history of any kind of criminal activity?
It's pure hell to start with. If it wasn't for my loving wife that I have here now today, I probably wouldn't have not have made it the first 2 or 3 years. Psychologically, it was extremely hard on me. I had never committed a crime in my life. I'd never been arrested, never been to jail. I never had any other charges filed on me, nothing. Clean as a whistle. Went to all the schools, public schools in Columbus, Ohio. Matriculated through the Ohio State University. Got a bachelor's and a master's degree. No problem. So when I went to the prison in Michigan, because they took me directly from the courtroom. They didn't give me a chance to come back to Columbus to get my affairs in order or anything. They took me and locked me directly up behind the judge's chamber. Well, I took off my clergy collar and ripped open my shirt and laid on the floor, and I said, in the words of old man Job, the Lord giveth and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And I stayed back there in that dark room when they turned off the lights and everybody went home until two big Washtenaw County sheriffs came and got me and took me to the jail. So basically, from there and for the first 2 years, it was very psychologically damaging. There's a lot of things that went on in the prison that some of the things I don't even like to talk about, the actual rapes, the beatings, the murders, all kinds of things happened in the Michigan prison system and in the Ohio prison system. Michigan, I believe, is even worse than Ohio because they have larger cities like Detroit and Flint and all those cities where they have a lot of real tough people, a lot of gangsters of all races. All ethnic groups. There's only one race, that's the human race, but different ethnic groups have all kinds of gangs in the prisons in Michigan. But basically, after I got my feet under me, and my wife and my mother would come and visit me, and my cousin Frank, I began to write 3 books. I licensed and ordained 24 men into the gospel ministry. And I would have prayer service every Sunday. And I would teach Bible study on Wednesdays and Saturdays. I was very well respected because I was very well educated. I was as peaceful as a lamb, but some of the men around me, they were tough enough to bite a telephone pole in half. And these are black, brown, red, and white men. So I didn't have any problems. I never got into any fights. I never got into any trouble because basically the Lord was with me and he protected me. He had his hand upon me. So I finished writing the 3 books that I told you about earlier. I guess 2 of them are still on Amazon Kindle, but I have not promoted them as of yet. I also licensed the 24 men. I would do Kwanzaa service, which is kind of like a black Christmas Kwanzaa every year. I would do a Christmas every year for all the prisoners. I did all kinds of things, and I brought Bibles, sacred name Bibles, because part of me is I'm Hebrew Israelite. My grandmother was Hebrew on my mother's side, and my grandmother on my father's side were also Hebrew. So I brought in Hebrew Bibles with sacred names like Yahweh. People say Yahweh, but it's really a V because it's a double V, not a double U. That's a long story. That's some linguistic lessons. But I brought in Bibles, probably hundreds of them, and gave them to men. And I taught them about my Lord and my Savior, Jesus the Christ, in English, Hebrew, Yahshua the Messiah. And I taught them. A lot of men turned their lives around. So in that sense, it was a positive thing. I'm still in touch with a number of men from the Michigan prison system who still write me and call me even to this day. And we fellowship. Some of them have ministries. Some of them have churches in Michigan. And they're doing great things. So I try to turn a negative into a positive. And that's what I'm hoping Mr. William Cosby will also do with his life. Every man has problems in his life. Every man goes through certain changes. Men and women go through certain changes. But if you can turn that around, if you can make your negatives and your weaknesses your strengths, then you can do a lot of things. That's what I did. Now, that's what I'm suggesting for people to do. Take the negative in your life and make it into a positive, and just trust in the Lord and lean on Him for all of your understanding, and then you will be blessed. And that's what has happened to me, Scott.
As a man of religion and the Lord, as you have said, do you ever wonder why the Lord let this happen to you?
Well, no, I really don't wonder why. You know, there is no why. These things, welcome to the earth. You know, we could talk about chattel slavery. Why for 400 years did they drag people from Africa over here and make them work without pay for 230-some years or so? Why did they take and commit genocide to the Native Americans and take and break all the treaties? Why did they do all... Why? There really is no why. These things happen in human history. We could go back. My specialty at OSU in college was ancient history. I'm a historian by training, and I studied ancient history and Renaissance and Reformation history. That was my specialty. But basically, things happen to people. Sometimes good things, bad things happen to good people, and sometimes good things happen to bad people. And there is no rhyme or reason to it, because we can't understand the mind of the Almighty. His ways are higher than our ways, as are the heavens are above the earth. So I heard an old preacher preach a sermon once, Scott. He said, it's just a test. The whole life of humankind is just a test. So we're being tested every day to see how we respond to these conditions. I looked at Mr. William Cosby, his several years in prison, and watched him come out victorious. I was really proud of him, because I believe he passed his test. Yes, he might have done some partying and had a casting couch like a lot of rich Hollywood moguls do, but he came out of that thing, and I believe he's going to do some good stuff. I've written a play that I would like for him to look at called Chattel Slavery, Then, Now, and in the Future, along with the three books. I was really trying to get in touch with him. I don't know if you have interviewed him yet or not.
No, he has not been on yet, but I have sent your information along to him, and he'll be on here very shortly, so hopefully there'll be some contact.
Well, hopefully I can listen to your show. Does it come as far as Columbus, Ohio?
Well, you can pick it up on the Internet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm going to go to your website, see if I can't pick your show up on a regular basis. My brother speaks so highly of you.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm a big fan of his, and we've had a lot of fun together.
Okay. Yeah. He's the entertainer in the family. I'm the activist. I'm trying to get our Congress people and people in the federal legislature to really lead from the front. People are trying to do things that are so politically correct, and they're so cautious. I'm saying, if you're an elected official, be a leader. Lead from the front. I talked to Congresswoman from Columbus, Joyce Beatty. I've talked to my Senator Sherrod Brown. I tried to get Senator Sherrod Brown to run for president several times, and he pulled out of the race, and the Washington Post said that when he pulled out that the Democrats lost their best chance to take the White House. But Sherrod Brown, I know him personally, know his family, know his daughter, know his grandchildren, know his ex-wife, know his wife. I know Joyce Beatty and her late husband, Otto. Otto was the state representative. He took my pastor's place, Phil D. Hale, when my pastor retired from the legislature. He was pastor of Union Grove Baptist Church, Dr. Hale was. And when he retired, Otto took his place, Otto Beatty. Otto Beatty just passed away about 3 months ago. That was Joyce Beatty's husband. And we were in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol building on February the 4th of 2020. And we were there as guest of the Congressional Black Caucus, and we were there. There were 400 people in the auditorium there in the Capitol. There were 1,000 more people in two overflow rooms that were watching. It was an emergency session, and the caucus was putting together, trying to get some answers. So we asked a lot of questions. We didn't come up with a lot of answers. That was February the 4th of 2020, and I'm trying to get a number of people to go back with a very peaceful demonstration. connection to the Capitol and also across to the Supreme Court building, which is right across the street, also down to the Federal Reserve Bank and the World Bank and the IMF and the BIS. IMF is the International Monetary Fund, BIS, Bank for International Settlements, and then walk over to the White House with a list of things that would help bring America together. Dr. Johannes J. Christian, a good friend of mine, he's blind. His eyes were knocked out with a brick over the freeway. Some bully, happened to be a white guy, a young man, teenager, 13, 14 years old, knocked his eyes out with a brick over the freeway. And that's why in Ohio, you have all the fences over the freeway, because in 2001, when that happened, and I think it was Governor Celeste had the legislature put these fences, they passed laws, there are fences over all the freeway overpasses. Dr. Johannes J. Christian is the executive director of a board that I'm on, Mobile, Mid-Ohio Board for an Independent Living Experience. Dr. Christian has no eyes. He has glass eyes, and he's called the Face of Forgiveness. Good friend of mine. Dr. Johannes J. Christian is getting ready to walk from Columbus to Washington, D.C. to try and bring love and unity and peace back to America. He's going to do that starting October the 1st through October the 14th, a two-week walk from Columbus to Washington, D.C. Dr. Christian is a great person. You can Google him, Face of Forgiveness. So I'm trying to work with everybody who's positive, who wants to bring America together, people who want to put things together in love. You know, I'm proud of just some Democrats. I'm proud of some Republicans. I like Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney is a great person. And I believe that her and several of the other Republicans are great people that are standing up and speaking out, speaking the truth. At the same time, I like some of the Democrats. Same time, I don't like some of the Democrats. Same time, I don't like some of the Republicans. So, you know, basically, it's that kind of a thing. It's good versus evil. It's right versus wrong for me. It's not Democrat or Republican or Green Party or Independent. It's good versus evil, right versus wrong. I think in America, if we want to come together, because a nation divided cannot stand, if we want to come together, we've got to come together in love. We've got to come together in peace. And we can't be afraid to speak out. That's why I'm talking about my case, even though I was convicted in 1992. You know, I'm not afraid to speak out about it because I'm speaking the truth. Your show, from what my brothers told me, your show is a great show because you bring people on there who are not afraid to speak the truth. Not their truth, but the truth. And tell it like it is. So basically, I'm very proud to have known you, very proud to have the opportunities that I have, but it's all a blessing from Almighty God. And that's where I stand with that, Scott.
Minister Ashe, as you have said, you are still a registered sex offender in,
yes, sir.
Yeah, in Ohio. What does that mean? What do you have to do, and how has that impacted your life?
Well, it's a terrible thing. It's terrible. Every 3 months, I have to go down and get a records check first from the Franklin County Sheriff's Office. Because in Michigan, the state police handles the registry. But in Ohio, the county handles the registry. So Franklin County handles it here in Ohio. And it's tied in with a federal database. So after I get my records check, then I go to the SCORN office, Sex Offenders Registration Office. And I have to sit there and wait. I have to go through a metal detector and all of that. And then I have to get my picture taken. And then they send my picture on a card out to all of my neighbors, probably to about 3,000 households in my community. It has my legal name, Kujenga Ashe. It has my name, my birth name, Everett Thomas Chubb. It has my age. It has my address. It has the number of the ordinance that I was convicted of in Michigan. All of that goes to all of my neighbors. Some of my neighbors are real mean. They nail them on telephone poles. They've cut and slashed my tires before. They broke my windows. All of that in the past. And it's a very difficult thing to have to go through a sex registration. And my registration is not for 5 or 10 or 20 years. It's for life. So if I go to any other state, I have to tell, if I stay in any other state more than 3 days, I have to register in those states with whoever carries the registry. So it's a major hassle to my work and my ministry as an activist. but I do that because I want to comply with the law. I got a lawyer. I paid him a lot of money to try to get me off the registration. He has not been able to do that as of yet. I talked to the former county prosecutor, who happened to be a Republican, but it didn't make me any difference. He tried to help me, but he was of no help at all. Now there's a Democrat who's the Franklin County prosecutor, and I'm trying to work with him to get off the registration list, and I do have an attorney, but as of yet, no success. But it's a terrible process that you have to go through, and every 3 months after you register, after I go through that process, they send a postcard from the Franklin County Sheriff's Office to about 3,000 of my neighbors on four streets surrounding me. And all of my neighbors get to see that every 3 months, and they've been seeing that every 3 months since 2011 when I moved back to Columbus. So for 10 years, every 3 months, you can do the math. They have cards stacked up on their shelves with my picture, and I have a suit and tie on, and a smile on my face, but they get to see, they get one of those every 3 months, and they collect those, and some people, like I said, have been very mean with that, but that's part of the process of being a registered sex offender. It's no fun, I can tell you that, and it's not beneficial, but once again, I use that negative as a positive. Since everybody knows me, I'll go around and knock on everybody's door and give them a flyer that says that I was innocent, and talk to them and try to get them to register to vote. I knock on all the doors. I pass out flyers with my wife. She's a Southland Area Commissioner. I knock on the door and I say, I know you know me because you get my sex offender registration card every 3 months, but, you know, I'm innocent of the crime, and here's a letter from the Southland Area Commission that tells you where you can go get your free food, you can go register to vote, you can go get your shot, or you can go, whatever it is that the Linden Area Commission is doing. I pass that out, and I talk to all of my neighbors, and I've been doing that for 11 years, once again making the negative into a positive.
Minister Ishe, a lot of people will say, because they hold rape even worse than murder in a lot of cases, because it especially if the victim is a young person, and a lot of people feel rape is a hard crime to convict somebody of because so many adult women do not go get tests done. It's usually not done in public. Obviously, the person perpetrating it would not want to do it in front of other people, so there would not be witnesses. And I think that's why people feel very serious and very angry about this particular issue. So in this case, where there might not be witnesses, where there might not be DNA evidence, what do you say to those people?
Well, basically, I just say to them, you know, you have to walk a mile in my shoes. We go back, like I said, once again, to chattel slavery. You know, all of the black people, quote-unquote, were products of rape, most of us. We're many different colors because the southern plantation owners raped the women, sometimes the boys, and the boys and girls too. But inside of me, as I stand here in my home in Columbus, Ohio, at 1119 East 16th Avenue, everybody knows the address anyway, so I'm not afraid to give it out. I am a quote-unquote black man. I'm a red man. I'm part Seminole and Cherokee Indian, as well as a Hebrew Israelite and African. I'm part black, brown, red man. I'm a part white man because the Chubbs in England, who were never slaves in America, who invented the tumbler lock. The Chubb family invented the black man, and the Mr. Jeremiah Chubb invented the tumbler lock, the locks that you have on today with the balls in them. Came to America. All the black people that came to America from my father's side were free black people when they got here, and they set up a town in Georgia, in Northwest Georgia, called Chubbtown. It's still there. My mother's people lived in Cedartown, Georgia, and of course their people were slave. My grandfather on my Mr. Hinkle on my grandfather on my mother's side was a white Indian. That's what they called him, a white Indian. And my grandmother was Hebrew Israelite. She's very light skinned. And then her mother was a dark-skinned Seminole Indian who lived in White Plains, Georgia. White Plains, Georgia, they migrated up there. Her name was Dale Kirkland. My great-grandmother on my mother's side was Dale Kirkland. She was a black Indian. She had long pigtails, and She lived in White Plains, Georgia, a little small town there.
Reverend Ishe, we've got to hit a break here, but you're going to be with us for the full 2 hours this morning. We're going to take about a 12-minute break, and Minister Ishe is going to come back with us, and we're going to talk more about where we just left off. We're going to go through that, but we're also going to talk about the work as he's doing as an ambassador to the United Nations, and hopefully we're going to hear the trumpet this morning, and I think Minister Ishe knows what I'm talking about. So hopefully,
they call me the trumpet man sometimes. I have a trumpet here.
So we're going to...
You want to hear it? I'll sound it for you.
We're going to hear all that in about 12 minutes with the continuing conversation and story of Minister Kujinga Ashe. Come back with us in about 12 minutes.
Thank you, Scott.
This was a fabulous thing that happened to me. 29 years, and imagine what happened during those times. And we talked about it, and it